I'd been reading about churches that have decided to put food courts in the lobby. What do you think? Is that a good idea? If we put a McDonald's or a Wendy's in the lobby, how many of you think that's a good idea? How many think it's a bad idea? How about a Starbucks? Good idea? Why is it a good idea or a bad idea? Why did you raise your hand and say it's a bad idea? Is it that you're not carb friendly? Or is there something about the fact of a business in the lobby that disturbs you? To answer that question, you might want to ask, what would Jesus do if he showed up at a church and saw people lining up for a mocha latte and a bagel special? You know, this is not a casual or lightweight thing. I went looking to see more about this on the internet. I typed in, food court, unquote, and churches, and I got 26,200 hits, just like that. It's obviously not just one church, and I scanned through the first few things. I didn't read all 26,000. But it's obvious that it's not just one church. This is a trend that's going on in evangelical churches. And the question is, what would Jesus say about that? What would Jesus do? Now, to answer that question, perhaps it would be instructive if we went to the passage in John, chapter 2, verse 13 and following, where Jesus responded to some commerce that was going on inside the temple. You probably know that at the end of his ministry, Jesus made a whip and cleared the temple, and three other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all report that. But you may not be aware that he did it more than once, and that at the very beginning of his ministry, he also did a very similar clearing of the temple of the commerce that was going on. And John has chosen to report that. And it's starting in verse 13. It's not the same event. There's very good reasons to understand that this is a different event. And it's got some important differences about it. But let's just read it together, and then let's just try and figure out, does Jesus want a Pizza Hut in the lobby? When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple. I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said, and then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now, how do you apply this passage to what's going on in many churches in our day and age by putting food courts in the lobby? How do we make the connection? Well, first, you have to really understand what was going on back in those days. You probably understand that observant Jews had to travel to the temple once a year at least for the special days. In this case, we're talking about Passover. And when they came, they would bring their sacrifice to present at the temple, a lamb or a cattle or dove or whatever it was, depending on how wealthy they were. And they would bring that with them, and they would also bring their temple tax, which amounted for every male Jew over 20 to a half a shekel. And the problem was, if you're coming from a long distance, as far as the animal sacrifice was concerned, if your animal turned his ankle on the way in or got damaged in any way during the trip, then he was no longer useful for a sacrifice. And then there was the related hassle of bringing him all that distance. So it was easier, more convenient, more comfortable in a lot of ways, for people to sell the animal that they would have sacrificed, take the money and bring it to Jerusalem and purchase a substitute in Jerusalem just outside the temple gates and bring him to sacrifice. And in the case of the money, there was many different kinds of currency in the Middle East at that time. And depending on where you lived, you would take your currency and bring it. And the only kind of currency that was accepted at the temple for convenience and also because it was especially pure silver was a coinage called Tyrian currency. Now, you want to remember that word Tyrian because it's really going to impact your salvation. That's just a little detail I threw in there to let you know I do read the commentaries. the Tyrian coinage was the only kind that they accepted at the temple, and you had to exchange your currency for their currency. And in both cases, the people who provided this service charged a little extra, just like they do at the airport as you're changing, you know, dollars to pesos or euros or whatever it is that the going currency is. They charged a little extra for their time and trouble. It was an accepted practice. But let's just kind of get a better feel for what was going on. This is a look at the side of Jerusalem right next to the Kidron Valley. And you see how steep this hill is right here. Here's the temple. This little road went down this very steep mountain and across this valley over to the Mount of Olives. Here's the Garden of Gethsemane here. But down in this valley and up on this slope here was where they set up the places to buy a sacrificial animal. And they also had the exchange booths over there. But you know how competition works. Eventually, somebody approached the temple authorities and said, well, how about if we set up inside the wall? And the first time somebody did that, they all came inside the wall because you'd be dumb if somebody was selling cattle in here to do it over here, you'd never sell any. And so everybody was inside there. Now for us, that seems like a big problem. How are you going to put all those cattle and everything in the lobby? Well, this was a huge complex. It encompassed at least an eighth of the whole town of Jerusalem. And it had its own fortress next to it, you know, a military complex attached to it. And here's a kind of a sketch of it. And if you look at the scope of this thing, look here at the doors and how tiny those are, and the stairs. And this is like a two- or three-story building. These columns here, as I understand it, were 50 feet high. So you can look at this thing, and you see this enormous courtyard in here that would be available. Imagine if these things are 50 feet high, how many sheep booths you could put in here. You see? And so it's not the problem that we think of when we're thinking of, you know, church. The actual worship and all didn't happen except for down in here. This, and it was separated by this balustrade. It's kind of a buffer zone. And as you got in close, this is where the worship happened. The Jews in general could go in here. Male Jews who had been ceremonially purified could go through the Nicanor gate into this little tiny area here and stand there. Well, the priests took the sacrifices and did those here. And then the holy place was here and the Holy of Holies was in there. So that there was walls of separation, you know, keeping everything straight. So you got, you know, maybe five different walls separating the people from the worship And all of this stuff that was going on in the courtyard is especially separated by this big buffer zone. So what's the problem? By the way, as I was looking for this, I found this picture, which is a picture, a photograph of the temple taken from an airplane back in those days. Oh, no, that's not right. This is a scale model that was constructed in Jerusalem. We saw this in 91 when several of us went there. See, this is a scale model. It absolutely takes your breath away. But here you go. This is the court of women and men who had not been purified could stand here for the worship part. And then this is the Nicanor Gate. And inside this wall, and you can see how substantial these walls are, inside there is where the men would stand for the sacrifices. This is the entrance to the holy place, and way back in here is the holiest place, the Holy of Holies. The worship is so far removed from the cattle and the exchange booths. What's the problem? Stands to make it easy to exchange your sacrifice or your temple tax out here? What's the big deal? To answer that question, to answer, you know, why is it that Jesus got so exercised? Why is it that he got so carried away to act out in such a hostile way? You need to, when you're reading through John, you need to kind of squint your eyes and look carefully at the details that are going on, because as we've seen time and time again as we study through John, there's the details really matter. And in this case, I want to look at two details that come from the mouth of Jesus. And the first one is this phrase, my Father's house. My Father's house. He says, how dare you? This in verse 16. He says, how dare you turn this into a market, my Father's house? Now, that's not just a casual phrase that Jesus uttered. That was a deliberate and none too subtle hint that the one who owned that temple was his father, that God was his father, that he was the son of God, that he was the Messiah. And we know that that's the way it came across, because even the disciples got it. And they were getting the willies, because they remembered in Psalm 69 there was this messianic prophecy, zeal for your house will consume me. That was interpreted as a foretaste of what the Messiah would be like. And here's Jesus fulfilling that, and the disciples were remembering this, and the little hairs are standing up on the backs of their necks, and they get it. And we know that they weren't the only ones who got it, but the temple authorities, the one that John calls the Jews, they also got it. And how do we know that? They didn't arrest him. You know, what would happen if somebody came in here high on meth and started tearing stuff off the walls and tipping over the coffee pot and so forth? Well, we'd get some of the biggest guys in here to jump on him and subdue him in Christian love. And then we'd dial 911, right? Well, these guys didn't need to dial 911 because they had a whole fortress full of soldiers right there. All they had to do was blow the whistle, and Jesus was toast. But they didn't do that. Instead, they said, what kind of a sign can you give us to prove that you have the authority to act this way? Well, act what way? To act like the Messiah. They got it too, sort of. But there's an inconsistency here. If they really got it, where do they get off asking for a sign? You know, if God is God and his anointed Messiah is standing in front of you, where do you get off doing anything but hitting the deck? Where do you get off instructing him as to what sort of a sign is appropriate? He just gave a sign. And they got it, sort of. But they're blind in their arrogance. And a lot of what was wrong here in this picture has to do with that blindness and that arrogance, that attitude that we can tell God what he will do. It's arrogance. We don't tell God what to do. We ask him in prayer what he will do. We tell him what we want, But in any case, these guys thought Jesus was acting like the Messiah. And so the first detail that we want to understand here is that the reason Jesus acted out as he did was to let people know in a non-too-subtle way that the Messiah had come. He was fulfilling the prophecy that he would be consumed with zeal for his Father's house. But that's not all of it. And the next detail I want to look at is this business where Jesus says this puzzling thing. He says, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days." Now, to figure this out, we need to remember the context of where this comes in the book of John. And as we've studied through the book of John, time after time after time, almost in every passage we've studied, there's been something that looks fairly ordinary on the outside. You think you get it, but when you look underneath and look deeper, it surprises you with the depth and the power of what it's really saying. You know, here comes a human being, and John says he's the Word. He's the Creator. He's a human being, but in him is life, and that life is the light of men. Remember? That's below the surface, because the darkness cannot see that. See, there's something going on that's below the surface that'll blow your mind if you see it. And the people at the wedding, you know, the servants saw this, these ceremonial water jars just prescribed by the law that had been filled with wine. That's what you see on the surface. It's amazing, but really amazing is the fact that Jesus Christ came to fulfill the law, to bring it to its intended complete purpose. Okay? So we've got all these going on, and then all of a sudden John tells us that Jesus made a whip and chased some people out of the temple. And he says, "Destroy the temple, get it up again in 3 days." And we must know from how John has been proceeding that something is going on under the surface here. And it's reasonable to assume that what's going on under the surface when Jesus says he'll raise up the temple is that he will fulfill the purpose for the temple. Because when he says destroy the temple, he's not talking about the buildings. You know, they reacted with scorn and indignation. "Hey, you've got 46 years to build this place, and you're going to raise it up in 3 days." And you know, all they could see was their big fancy building, but the temple is not the building. The temple is the purpose for which God told people to build the building. We would be good to not forget that. The church isn't the building. It's the purpose for the building. And when Jesus said, "Destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days," with all my heart, I believe that the impact, even though he didn't say it this way, I believe the impact was, "Destroy this temple, I'll raise it up 3 days." In other words, you are destroying this temple. How dare you destroy the purpose of this temple? But never mind. Even though you will destroy this temple and are destroying it, I will fulfill it, bring it to its completed purpose in 3 days' time. Now, what is the purpose of the temple? Well, you can see the purpose by the architecture. I mean, if you walk into a kitchen, you know what its purpose is because you can see the architecture is set up to accomplish the purpose. You walk in this room, you know what the purpose of this room is. You walk into a bathroom, you know what the purpose is because the architecture is set up for a particular purpose. Same thing with the temple. And God didn't tell him to just build it any old way. He told him to build it a specific way so it would fulfill his purpose. Now, if you notice this building here, notice all the walls. And as you go in through the gates, you're going past all these walls and you get closer and closer to the center of this thing. And way in here, enclosed almost entirely by separating walls, is this special room, which is the dwelling place of God on earth. That's the purpose for the temple. It's the focal point of where God will dwell with his people on earth. Okay? But there's another purpose is not just simply, you know, this would be like the throne room. If this was a palace, it'd be like a king sitting on his throne. Well, but, you know, you don't seal the king off in the throne room. There's got to be a way to get to him. And the second purpose for the temple is for the people to be able to approach or connect to God. It's a purpose for the temple. But you know that we're separated from God. And what are we separated by? Sin. And so to get to God, this temple is set up to provide a means to take care of the sin. And it's right here at the place of the altar. And the sacrifice is made for the sin. And then the priests, on behalf of the people, are able to connect to God. That's all set up. And it's exposed in the architecture, see? But it's not just simply the dwelling place for God and a place for people to connect to God. It's also the place for God to connect to the people by his word delivered out and impacting the lives of the people. You see, it goes on out through the priests, on out to the men, on out to the people in general. And it's not just to the Jews. It was never just to the Jews. God's original purpose was always to go on out through the Jews and on out to the rest of the world. That was the purpose. And the temple is designed in that way, so that the word of God, the impact of God, the blessing of God gets out across this buffer zone, this balustrade, and on out here to the court of the Gentiles. This wall right here is the dividing wall of hostility that Paul talks about in Ephesians 2, where he says that in Christ, this dividing wall has been taken down, and there's no longer any separation between the Gentile and the Jews. This buffer zone was a separation between the Gentile and the Jews. But God's purpose was never to leave it separate. It needed to be separate for his purpose to get out to all the people. The purpose was kind of like the purpose of an explosion. He said in Genesis 28, first book of the Bible, said, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. That's the plan. That's the purpose. And they were to reach out through them. If you look at this, what you see here is if God's blessing is an explosion, a bomb, well, you need a trigger for the bomb. Now, I was going to go research the right names for this on the internet, and then I realized, you know, there's people watching who's trying to figure out how to build a bomb on the internet, so I decided not to do it that way. So forgive me if you bomb experts out there know what the real words are, but it's my understanding that you can't just light a match to an atomic bomb. You need to explode something inside it that's essentially pure and ready to go off. And then the rest of it can go. And that's essentially what God did. He separated out his people, the Jews. He gave them his word, his law. And the plan was to bless all the peoples of the world through them as they reached out across these dividing lines. This dividing line is essentially what you got on a bomb to separate the trigger from the rest of the bomb, so that the center part will be pure and ready to go off. So what was Jesus upset about? Well, where were they setting up the cattle? In the court of the Gentiles. What does that mean? That means if a Gentile wanted to seek God, and a Gentile just simply means anybody who's not Jewish, so it just means ethnos in Greek, the peoples of the world, anybody. If they want to seek God, anybody, and they come into the temple, and they hear all this bleating of sheep and mooing of cows and clamor of money changers, how are they going to do it? You see what had happened? The Jews had destroyed the temple. They destroyed its essential purpose because they made it tough for the outside world to get in. And they treated the whole place like a private club for members only. Why did they put commerce in here? It's for the convenience and comfort of the members only. And it was at the expense of the people God intended to reach through them. That make sense? That's why Jesus said, you're destroying this temple, but I'll raise it up. And he was talking about his body. Now think about the purposes of the temple. Jesus' body, his body. I'm not talking about the church. His body was the dwelling place of God on earth. It's the perfect, fulfilled dwelling place of God on earth, right? It was also the place where the sacrifice was made so that people could connect to God. And it was also the center place from which, through the Word, God's blessing would go out. See that? It's the fulfilled purpose for the temple. So, Jesus was so upset because they were not entering the kingdom of heaven themselves, and they were keeping others out. And by doing that, they completely reversed God's plan for the temple. It wasn't about the building. It wasn't about the Jews. It was about the peoples of the world, including the Jews. He just simply used them as his witnesses, his representatives, his mouthpiece. So, what's that mean for us? How would Jesus feel about a Wendy's in the lobby? To answer that question, you have to start with the principle. What is the purpose of the church? And does that food court in the lobby enhance the accomplishment of that purpose or detract from it? Is there anything that we do that thwarts the purpose of the church for the comfort and convenience of members only? Think about that. In other words, what would Jesus do?